You're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast with your host, Giovanni Puccini. Hey there, everyone. This is Giovanni Puccini of the GP Soccer Podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the wonderful world of podcasting, the greatest thing in the world. You know that. Podcasting is a boatload of fun for me, as I've told you in the past. And on your end, how cool is it at any time of your day or evening, you can pop in your favorite podcast and check it out and play it over and over and over again, 2 o'clock in the morning, in your pajamas. You want to listen to the GP Soccer Podcast, you can do that. It's a great, great, great piece of technology. So here we are. To kind of give you some context, folks, where we're at in terms of the date and what's going on in the world. When this airs, you know, this it'll be some point in May of 2020, and we're here now around the end of April. We are still in the midst of the COVID-19 crisis, the pandemic. You know, it is now part of everyone's conversation. It's now a part of everyone's life, and certainly in the soccer community, that this is no different. So, as one who is serving the soccer community via podcasting, I think it's appropriate to continue to have these conversations and talk about the new normal with folks, soccer professionals in the game, and how it's affected their lives personally, and certainly how it's affected their lives professionally. We've chatted with folks who are in the in the club community and certainly in the collegiate community. And our guest today is in that community as well. And I think it's important to share our stories about how we're dealing with the coronavirus so that when we're, when we're beyond all this, and we will get beyond all this, we're better for it. So today, I have another interview guest. And again, I said this before and I will say today, I've been so thankful for the number of people, wonderful people who have agreed to come on the GP Soccer Podcast because they've been great contributors to the show. And today is no exception. So our guest today is Dr. Missy Price. Dr. Missy Price is currently the head soccer coach at Wellesley College in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Dr. Price has been coaching at the college level for over 20 years with stops at the Universities of Virginia, Illinois, Miami, and Nevada. Her PhD is in sports psychology, and she spent her career developing coaches and players to maximize their potential. Missy is a leader in the soccer industry, advocating for women in coaching, as well as serving on the board of directors for United Soccer Coaches. A former goalkeeper from Eastern PA, Price played at the University of Maryland, helping lead her team to 2 NCAA Elite 8 appearances. She's a strong proponent of coaching education, having been an instructor for both U.S. Soccer and United Soccer Coaches. She holds both the United Soccer Coaches Premier Diploma and U.S. Soccer A license. Dr. Price has recently presented on topics such as using mindfulness in sport and developing strong coach-athlete relationships through effective communication. Missy is the proud mom of 2 young children, Kaya and Cruz, and believes that parenting has made her a better coach and mentor. Currently, Dr. Price is working with leaders from numerous coaching communities to support parents, players, and coaches as we all navigate the challenges of COVID-19. Dr. Missy Price, welcome to the GP Soccer Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, Giovanni. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited to talk with you. And as far as I know it, right, we're not that far apart from one another.
We're not far. Well, I don't know where you live, but your college is in Wellesley. I'm in Quincy. I'm on the South Shore of Boston. So we're not too far away. As a matter of fact, I am the goalkeeper coach at Regis College over in Weston, which is a town away. So, I'm surprised our paths have not crossed. You and I have been involved with United Soccer Coaches for a gazillion years. I think I'm a little older than you, so maybe 2 gazillion years on my end. But here we are. Our paths have indeed crossed here on the GP Soccer Podcast, and it's great to have you on board. So at the opening there, at the setup, I did mention the coronavirus issue. So I want to ask first, from a personal standpoint, how are you doing and how is your family doing as we all deal with this, this pandemic crisis?
I would say if you asked me that 5 weeks ago, I would have given you a different answer, but I'm doing really well. I'm very thankful that My family that's spread out a little bit all up and down the East Coast, we are all doing well and healthy. And here in Massachusetts, my wife and my kids and I have been doing the stay-at-home orders and just really trying to juggle, you know, both working and taking care of our two young kids. But there has been this unusually positive opportunity. My son started walking in these last 6 weeks, and I got to see every minute of that. And my daughter is 3, and she's turning into a 13-year-old, and I get to experience every minute of that. So I think, you know, with coaching, it's not a 9-to-5 job, right? It's a anytime job. And I think that sometimes you're trying to balance being a coach and being a parent. And this sort of unusual time that we've been at home, I've been able to do some of my coaching in a different way. The way I spend time with my team right now is the way we're all spending time with one another virtually. But I spent a lot more time with my kids, and I've really enjoyed that. And as much as this is hard for everyone, I'm thankful for that. So I'm trying to maintain that positivity and take this time to really enjoy that, because I know someday it'll be different and I won't have this kind of time with them.
So you said, is it he or she walking?
He, son,
so
Cruz.
He is walking. Yeah. Is he kicking a soccer ball yet?
Oh yeah, he is.
Of course.
He is, of course.
We wouldn't
That's
have
one
it any
thing
other
we do
way.
Every day. Yeah, my daughter loves it. She's like, come out. She calls it chase. She says, come out and play chase with me. And it's really, she dribbles the soccer ball around and I have to chase her. So that's our version of soccer right now. But it's fun.
And there you go. It's a workout for you as well, chasing her around the backyard as she kicks the soccer ball around. So so I want to ask you also from a professional standpoint, you kind of intimated this already, you know, the new normal with your team over at Wellesley. What was the process as an institution, as a collegiate institution, in dealing with this, you know, as it was coming? What were the conversations, what were the processes that Wellesley College was going through to reach a point where it was like, okay, it's time to shut down, it's time to reevaluate how we're going to move forward academically and then athletically, how do we move forward? What was that process like?
You know, I think it was, for me, we were supposed to take the team to Spain for a spring break trip, you know, so foreign tours, they're planned years in advance kind of thing, and our spring break was the end of March, last week in March. And the last week in February was when we started the first case in Spain, I think, became public knowledge. And all these questions started to be raised of, should we go to Spain? So for us personally as a team and me as a coach and a faculty member at Wellesley, that's where I would say the process started. And we started looking into, you know, is that safe? Is that doable? And then at the same time, the college was starting to evaluate study abroad programs and other things like that, because it, you know, the crisis hadn't quite hit our country in the way that it has now, right? And so for us at Wellesley, that's kind of how it all started, with a discussion of, you know, me going to our athletic directors and saying, should we be going on this trip? I don't know. And that going all the way up, obviously, to the provost level of the college and the presidents. And while they were filtering through our conversations, they were also dealing with all the other students and whether they were on campus or off campus and study abroad. And it all kind of happened at the same time. So our trip was canceled about a week to 10 days later. And then about 2 weeks after that, the campus was closed and students were headed home to finish the semester remotely. So in some ways, honestly, Giovanni, it all happened so fast, because we were like a month out. I had just had our team meeting, like, yay, you know, 30-day countdown, we're going. And then we weren't sure if we were going, and then we weren't going, and then everybody was going home. So I think the college did a fantastic job of thinking on their feet and adapting as the situation adapted. In some ways, we thought we'd be there until spring break, and then they would just maybe potentially not return. That had seemed to be the theme a little bit, at least in the Boston area with some of the other colleges. And then all of a sudden that changed pretty rapidly, and that date got moved up by about 10 days. And for the college to handle that and facilitate students moving off campus, and the managing the emotional toll of all that on everyone, including faculty members. It was a lot, to be honest. And I think that they did a great job of supporting students, faculty, and staff through the whole thing. It's unprecedented, right? Like, none of us have experienced anything like this. And so everybody's kind of having to make decisions on the fly with as much information as you have in that moment. And then that changes the next day. And I think, you know, we've potentially settled down a little bit with that. And we're nearing the end of the semester for our students with classes. And so that sort of feels like it was a long time ago, but it certainly was a roller coaster at the time, for sure. I've been home basically since Friday the 13th of March was my last day at Wellesley, where I was on campus working. I met with the team on the night before when they announced that students would be returning home. And since then, it's all been, you know, text, phone calls, Zooms, all those things to try to help them through this and manage it all, both personally and professionally.
Yeah, you know, you kind of hit it right on the head, you know, in the respect that there's no plan for this. I mean, there's no plan for it at any level. When you have something so unforeseen and to the magnitude that it has engulfed our world, I don't know. How do you plan for that? You know, you plan for the flu, you plan for, you know, these are things that we're familiar with in terms of, you know, health issues, but this is a doozy. This is a historic one, you know, to deal with. And you know, I'm fascinated because I've interviewed other college coaches while we're in the midst of all this. And I'm curious of their process, because every process is different. Every process is indeed different. So you mentioned staying in contact with your team. What are some of the things you mentioned? You're doing Zoom. What are the things you're trying to do to make sure that, you know, that they're having some sort of engagement during the spring season? Obviously, you can't train as a team, but what are some of the things that you're expecting your players to do during this time to kind of stay engaged with the game?
Yeah, so I think this is something where I've actually struggled a little bit with it as a coach, to be honest. It's been like, how much is too much? How much is not enough? And trying to find that sweet spot for my team and what I think they need. And Wellesley students come from all over the country. So I have students East Coast, West Coast. I even have one in Mumbai, India. And so I think, like, being able to, my thing to them this entire time has been, number one, supporting them. And that's very individualistic because they each need something different. Number two is connection to their staff and to each other. And to their other community members at Wellesley, their friends, their other students they've met. And then the last one is fun, like just trying to find some joy in this, because it's really easy to go down a rabbit hole of, like, you know, this sucks and this is not what I wanted and this is not anything I had hoped for, both from a coaching standpoint and from a player standpoint. And I don't think that's helpful for anyone. So we gave them some time to get settled into their routine. We actually didn't start any formal team stuff until they had already been in classes for a week and got to kind of figure that out. And then we meet once a week as a team on Zoom. We have a theme for that, and we're working on our mental toughness. And then I told them, I was like, this is perfect. If anything's going to challenge our resiliency, it's this, and your ability to adapt and respond to these sort of changing emotions and deal with some anxiety. I mean, this is it. If you can improve through this scenario, then you're going to be a stronger athlete and a stronger person when you come out of this. So it turns out that worked out well for me, because that was our theme already. So we've been working a lot on our mental toughness and trying to do that through some activities through Zoom. Twice a week, we send them an individual ball workout that's like a video. And we're focusing on, you know, you have to do it in your driveway or your basement, or, you know, you don't have a lot of space. You don't have a backyard. We have players that live in the city and don't really have an option. So something they can do in their living room. So we're focusing on small spaces, lots of touches on the ball, juggling outside if they can somewhere, those kinds of things. So they get something twice a week with that. And then they're connecting on their own outside of the coaches. So they actually have more sort of social things like movie nights or hangouts where they hang out together without the coaches. And I know that they're all really enjoying those. And we're doing some fun things. We play, there's this thing called Game Pigeon, which they introduced me to. I didn't know about it, where you kind of play a video game versus each other via text. And we played a couple of those as a team. So it's been fun. And everything we talk about when I talk with my team leaders and things is connect, support, and have fun. And, you know, that's what we need in order to get through this. And the soccer isn't going to be the same. And the school isn't going to be the same, but it doesn't mean that different is bad. So how can we make some opportunity out of this and getting them to constantly think about that?
You know, it does force all of us to begin to think outside the box relative to our own growth and development as human beings, never mind what we do in terms of our profession. But it's forced, like I'm a director of coaching education for the Super League, which is down in Rhode Island. And we have 38 clubs, 542 coaches, and 10,000 players. And here I am recently hired as a DOCE, and I have yet to step foot on the field to conduct, you know, clinics and sessions and that type of thing. So it has forced me as a DOCE to think outside the box to keep my coaching community, which is rather vast, engaged. So, you know, I'm doing coaching videos, I'm doing newsletters, we're doing a guest series where guest coaches come in and talk to the coaching community in the Superliga, stuff like that to keep people engaged in the soccer. And it's made me a better soccer professional, because now I'm forced to think outside the box. I'm forced to do other things to engage the community of which I work in. You mentioned mental toughness. Mental toughness. I had a recent interview with Dan Abrahams over in the UK, who does a lot of work with the highest level of players in the EPL and in other sports as well. And our colleague Dr. Bill Steffen of United Soccer Coaches has done a lot of work, a lot of research in mental toughness. And they, like you, had indicated this is an opportunity to really test players' mental toughness. I don't think there's anything, in fact, I know there's nothing on the field or in a training environment that can force someone to really be mentally tough compared to a pandemic. So, let's shift gears. I'm always curious about my guest's story. What is the Missy Price story? Take us back to the, when you were a kid. How did you start playing soccer? Why did you start playing soccer? Who are your role models? Navigate my audience down your life path that ultimately led you to Wellesley, and certainly spend some time navigating the audience, with your path toward being a coach educator and your passion and commitment toward the development of coaches in our country.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. So the way the story goes, according to my parents, was we were in the car. I was somewhere around 5 or 6 years old, and we were like sitting in traffic at a stoplight. And my mom said that I was like yelling at her to get her attention from the back seat. And when she finally looked at what I was talking about, she was looking at a soccer field, which at the time in the very early 80s, she didn't really know what that was that she was looking at. She went to work the next day and talked to some of her friends at work, and they said, yeah, there's soccer, kids play it, here's the information, kind of for the local recreational league type thing. And she signed me up. So I don't remember it other than looking back at sort of some pictures of those early days and her telling me that story. And I remember, though, playing soccer as a kid and just loving running around. So I wasn't a goalkeeper initially, obviously, like most people aren't. I just loved running around and being active and sort of chasing the ball and being on a team. I really remember enjoying the team aspect of things and the social connection. I can remember some of my soccer friends, from as young as 8 or 10 years old. And really enjoying that. And turns out I got pretty good at it. And I was also always the kid, the game would start, someone would have to play goalkeeper, right? And everybody had to rotate through. And because I wanted the game to start so bad, I'd always volunteer to go first. So I got in the goal a lot. My dad says I seem to take great pride in not wanting to get scored on as a little kid. I would just dive all over the place and swat the ball out and wasn't afraid to do that. But I never liked it. I never liked being a goalkeeper until I was probably about 12 or 13. And back then, the state ODP system was, it was kind of like you played in your local club, right? And then you tried out for a select team. And from there, you tried out for the state team. You made that. You went to the regional camp. And it's similar system today, but not quite the same. And I remember going to state team tryouts and not making it. And all my friends made the team. And they asked me, we hear you play in the goal and we don't have a goalkeeper. And if you want to play in the goal, it's kind of along the lines of paraphrasing here, but if you want to play in the goal, we'll take you. But you need to try out as a goalkeeper. So I wasn't good enough as a forward. My friends were on the team, and socially, I was like, man, I got to be with these people. I love hanging out with them. So I tried out as a goalkeeper, and I made it. And ever since then, I trained and played the game as a keeper. Had some really wonderful experiences with Region 1 ODP team, going on trips to the interregional events and over to England and places like that when I was a teenager, and ended up being a goalkeeper at the University of Maryland. And so that's where my story kind of twists and turns. When I was a young regional team player, I met April Heinrichs. She was at an event we went to in Wisconsin. And several years later, when I became eligible to go to college, I got a letter from her at the University of Maryland. And she mentioned remembering me when I was a player on the regional team and watching me play in Wisconsin. And I thought that was amazing. And she wanted me to take a look at the University of Maryland. And I looked at several other schools on the East Coast and ended up landing there. And soon after that became my interest in coaching. I've been really fortunate. I feel like I've had a lot of wonderful mentors, both male and female mentors along the way. But one that stood out to me, and many people that probably listen to your show know her, you probably know her, is Charlotte Moran. And she was our administrator in Eastern Pennsylvania. She trusted me to do a lot of different things. But what she did when I came home from college my first summer was sign me up for my D license, and then call me and tell me that she did, and told me where I had to be in order to get it that weekend. And from there became sort of this, wasn't quite passion yet, felt like obligation, an obligation, which is not a negative thing. It was an obligation to give back. And that was something that I learned through Charlotte, through a lot of the coaches that I had met through our state system in Eastern Pennsylvania and through the ODP system in Region 1. And today I serve on the board with Sue Ryan, and she was the board for United Soccer Coaches with Sue Ryan. And she was one of the women who influenced me all the way back when I was a player. So my story kind of goes on from there. And I later graduated from the University of Maryland and went to work with April when she was the head coach at the University of Virginia. And she instilled in me from the day I arrived was, you need to be educated as a coach, both through United Soccer Coaches, which at the time was the NSCAA, and U.S. Soccer. Get as much education as you can. She supported me in that. I had my C license at that point already. I had gotten it right when I graduated from college. And that just became a part of what I did. I was in grad school getting a master's in sports psychology. So education in itself has always been important to me as a person, learning and growing. And from there, I actually was hired to work for Joe Ellis at the University of Illinois. And she later got the job at UCLA, and I stayed at Illinois. But another huge mentor in my life, she was also my assistant coach at the University of Maryland. So I've been super fortunate with kind of that college playing career and the people in my life that I got to see their coaching careers evolve as well. April later became a national team coach, so did Jill, and and to be part of that coaching tree has been, I just feel really grateful. They're both still mentors and people in my life that I could call up and ask for advice or help on. But after being at Illinois, for me, it was, again, continually just striving to educate myself. Moving through my licensing with U.S. Soccer and through United Soccer Coaches, working in a couple different Division I institutions, I took a break for a few years from full-time college coaching to finish my PhD in sports psychology. Thought I was going to be a professor and coach youth soccer, and I missed the college team so much, I ended up going to the University of Nevada and working for a good friend of mine, Jaime Frias, who's at the University of Virginia now, ironically. UVA seems to be a tie that always comes back into my story. And he got me back into the coaching world. I took over for him at Nevada when he left, and that was my first head coaching job in 2010. And at the time, I had a really fantastic athletic director, Carrie Groth, at Nevada, who showed a lot of belief in me. And I worked at that program. But I think one of the things I discovered along the way, and this is what I really talk to coaches about now, is kind of understanding your why. Why do you do what you do? Who are you as a coach? And what are your values and your philosophy? And does that align with where you are, whether that's club, high school, college, and not just the level, like the actual institution or club that you work for. And to be strong in believing who you are and what you value. And if it doesn't quite align, it might not be perfect, but it's got to align for you to be able to feel like you can deliver your passion through coaching. And later in my career at Nevada, I started to think about a transition to the D3 level. The job at Wellesley opened up, and Wellesley is a fantastic institution. Its core value basically is developing women to go out and make a difference in the world. And that is a strong, strong value that runs through me. And it became basically a match made in heaven. And I ended up getting the job, and I've been here for 4 years now, and it's awesome. I'm developing leaders through our student body, through our student athletes, and Wellesley really supports what I like to do outside of my responsibilities there, which is serving on the board of directors for United Soccer Coaches and helping coaches and parents and student athletes really develop themselves as people and support this whole idea of soccer in our country. So I feel like I have my dream job, and I absolutely love it. So I hope that wasn't too long of a story. I definitely cut a few things out, but that's the general gist.
No, not at all. I spent my entire career when I was a head coach, which was, my goodness, I don't know, 26, 27, 20 years. It's all a blur at this point in my life. As a Division III coach, and had opportunities on a number of occasions to move up the proverbial ladder, as they say, but chose to stay at the Division III level for what you just kind of mentioned. I think at that level, at the Division III level, you have more of the capacity because of the philosophy behind the Division III athletic to make more of an impact on a young person's life. And you at the Division I level, not that you can't do that at the Division I level, you can't, but as well as I do, at the Division I level, the pressure to win, to get results is sometimes first and foremost over, I want to make sure that these young men or these young ladies become good human beings. Whereas at the Division III level, there's less pressure to win, if you will. And that's one of the things that I embraced. Plus, I'd like small schools. I like small campuses. I like the more, personal appeal at the Division III level. And I stayed there. I made a professional decision a long time ago to stay at that level. I certainly have no regrets. So that part of your story certainly resonates. So before I dive in, I want to spend a lot of time with you in two areas. That's in coaching education and, developing, young ladies in the game, young female coaches, and your role in that, your passion in that, because, even though I'm a guy, you just asked my wife, I'm the feminist in the family. And that's one of the things that I really want to talk more about. And when I get out there doing coaching education courses, in which I do a number of them, my survey radar goes up. I look across a class, whether it's a grassroots class or something more advanced. I go, well, how many women are in this course? And there's not enough. So I want to dive more into that you know, later in our conversation. But before I get there, the Development Academy, I really want to get your take on the demise of U.S. soccer and the Development Academy. You know, after weeks and weeks of rumor, you know, will it go, will it stay? It finally bit the dust. What's your take on the demise of the DA? What's your take on its effect on the soccer landscape? You know, ESNL, you know, and the girls and the boys. Take a look at the entire soccer landscape at the highest levels, and what's your take on all of this as it pertains to the soccer landscape here in the United States?
You know, I think just as much as we are going to see things be very different in a lot of ways when we emerge out of this COVID-19 crisis, you know, our daily behaviors and the way that we can go about our business might be a bit different. I think you're going to see the same thing in the soccer world, and not because of COVID-19 and not directly because of the DA folding, but everything is kind of a chain of events, right? And I think that there was some, you know, positive experiences, especially as a coach more on the girls' side, right? Is seeing a something like the DA develop for the girls where it had been around for the boys for a long time, right? And that was exciting. And it changed the soccer landscape for club soccer in our country and for high school soccer. And even our youth programs will sort of lead into clubs. So when you're playing at the youngest ages. So I think it's, again, I would like to frame it in the sense of opportunity. With the DA folding, you look at it and you're like, what the heck happened? And what's, you know, so you can look at it from the slant of what's going on with US soccer and, you know, why do they do this and why do they do that? Like, but I'd like to look at it as the sense of opportunity. And I think we're going to see things change and evolve. And I don't know what it's going to look like, but sometimes you think there's less opportunity because of something. And I actually think there might be more opportunity now for players. One of the big, obviously, issues with the DA was the idea that you couldn't play high school soccer and the impact that had on high school numbers. You know, so what's going to change there? What are we going to see? Are we going to see players making the choice to play for their high school teams more frequently now? I don't know, right? But I think that's opportunity. Clubs returning to the ECNL, you're already starting to see that happen. You know, my Twitter feed or leagues developing, leagues changing the way that structure of their leagues in order to absorb some of these DA teams. Again, opportunity. So I think it'll be some time before we actually see how it all impacts both the girls and the boys side of things. United Soccer Coaches recently had a podcast. Was this week? That was yesterday, right? I think. But look for it. There's a podcast with all the leaders from like USU Soccer, United Soccer Coaches, the ECNL, and talking about, you know, essentially now that the DA is no longer here, what is the impact on our youth soccer in our country? So I think that would be even a great place to start for coaches to kind of start to see where are we going to go from here. And, you know, for me, I think as a college coach on the women's side, and when you talk about coaching education, for me, I think it's about the expansion of clubs. Coaches maybe who are coaching a DA team and now they become an ECL team or an NPL team, wherever they may be, it's irrelevant, but that clubs could maybe grow and expand in such a way that they're able to better support the number of coaches that they had. So if you had a smaller club now who maybe doesn't have the financial resources to provide the coaching education and the degree that which they would like, they've absorbed some teams, they've grown into a larger club, and they're able to provide some really excellent coaching education, parent support, and student-athlete support for their players. You know, I'd like to see those opportunities potentially come into play here. So with the boys, I know there's a lot of talk about the sort of the development through the MLS clubs. So if you have the MLS behind some of these teams, you'd like to think that those same opportunities will exist as far as coaching education and, you know, the financial support for coaches and players and parents. So to me, it's opportunity, and I'm very interested to see how it changes and evolves. There'll obviously be an impact probably on things like college recruiting and events, and we'll see our recruiting schedule change, because when the DA came in, you're like, all right, now I got to go to DA events. Now with the DA out, what will that look like for us? So it's an exciting time, I think, for an evolution in youth soccer in our country, and I'm glad I'm here to be a part of it and support everyone through it. So
the cynic in me says, here we go again with U.S. soccer, shooting themselves in the foot. Again, I'm a little older than you, and I go back a ways. when we saw, outside, and this is really tell you how old I am, when our national team was actually a franchise in I believe it was the North American Soccer League, they tried that. And then we tried, having a home down in Florida for all our best players, and we'll ship all our players down there, we'll develop them there. And, we start with the DA, but why the DA just for boys? And then we'll do girls as an afterthought. And there's my feminism coming through again. And then the optimist in me is like you. Well, here's an opportunity. Here's an opportunity. But the cynicism creeps its way into my optimism is will they get it right for once? And if you listen to previous shows, and I hope you do, and my audience has heard me say this on numerous occasions, the United States of America is not Germany, is not the Netherlands, is not England, is not Belgium, is not, any one of those types of countries. The soccer landscape, the football landscape is obviously different. Our sporting culture here in the United States is vastly different than the aforementioned countries. Therefore, we have to think differently. We have to think in terms of the American dynamic and not how it's done in different spots around the world. So kind of to that end, is it even possible, given the nature of what the United States is, to even run an elite developmental entity here in the United States? Is that even possible? And can MLS even come close to filling that gap?
I'm probably on the cynical side as you.
Go ahead, spell it. Go ahead. You can. It's just me and you talking here, Missy. No one else is listening. Go ahead.
No one else is listening.
No, it's just me and you.
I think it's a challenge too. I say that from my own experience. So if you think about where I've lived and worked, I'm in the Boston area right now, major metropolitan area. There's I feel like 52 clubs within a 30-minute driving distance of me, right? Of all different levels. But I lived in Reno, Nevada, much smaller as far as a soccer community. But right over the hill, you're in Northern California, huge soccer community. I've lived in Champaign, Illinois, small community in the middle of Illinois, 2.5 hours from Chicago, where you think of sort of the mecca of soccer in Illinois. So I've lived all over. Same thing. I lived in South Florida and Miami. Sure, tons of soccer. Even a love of the game that's different, given sort of the multicultural and ethnic makeup of the community. So tons of soccer down there. But you're sort of also so far down in the state, you're somewhat disconnected from the rest of that state because the state's so large, right? So I think it's a challenge for two reasons. It's a geographical challenge, but I'm also going to throw this out there. I think it's a challenge because culturally, we're still in a little bit of a place where as a soccer community, I think that we do less to support and lift up one another, and we do more to compete against one another. And I think that's where we have to take a good close look at ourselves. And to kind of relate back to the COVID-19 crisis, we're doing that right now. The number of webinars, podcasts, like every day, I could be on a webinar that is free that normally isn't, let's say, or it's just coaches of all different levels, experience, even some all over the world, coming together to learn and share ideas. And I think that I haven't seen or felt that kind of connection to the greater coaching community, like to my own little network, sure, but to the greater community and learning from people that I don't always either have access to or just don't know who they are. And I have been exposed to more people in this time. I think that's what's fantastic. And I think that's what's the strength of our country is we have really good soccer coaches and minds out there at all these different levels. But in some ways, we're super protective of what we have because we have to be better. We have to be better than the club next door. We have to be better than the high school next door. We have to be better than the college that we play against. And being better doesn't always mean that you're going to share ideas because your ideas have to be the ones that help you win. So I think those are our challenges. I think we, as a country, if we could come together a bit more, we would realize the power in that. But that's also challenging geographically, and it's a little challenging culturally because we're a little too competitive, I think, sometimes for our own good, even though I'm competitive and I hate to lose. If you're going to share an idea with me, Giovanni, and it's going to help me make my team better and make them better people and make me a better coach, then I want that. I want that idea, not to beat you, but to make them better. And that's what I'd love to see us evolve and be better at so that we can grow the game in our country.
Well, I like you, feel the same way. I think if you're an enlightened human being, you remain open-minded and you do. You want to learn more, not so much for your own, you know, self-development, so to speak, but I can take this and make other people better. You know, you hit something on the head that I rail about, have been for a number of years, and that's the competing entities in our country, both at the macro level and at the micro level. You know, at the micro, I'll start with that one first. There is a soccer club on every street corner. On every street corner. You know, there's a club popping up here, there's a club popping up there because they think they can do it better. Certainly, you can't have that micro conversation without talking about the pay to play, and they can do it because they, you know, they want to make some money at the game, and by that very nature, by that very dynamic, it becomes inherently competitive. I don't want to share with that club what I'm doing or not doing because, you know, they might get better, and if they get better and they win, I may lose players, I may lose coaches, I may go out of business, or it's going to cut my bottom line. So we become super, super self-protective of our soccer club entities because, well, let's face it, because of a bottom line, a dollar value. Now, at the macro level, my goodness, you know, unlike other countries, we've got so many entities, United Soccer Coaches, U.S. Soccer, MLS, NWSL, USYS, the list goes on. It's an alphabet soup of entities that may not be financial in terms of their protection of their entity, but the thought process, and this is just one man's opinion, we can do it better, or this is how we think, and this is how we want to go forward. And when you combine the macro and micro entities, we have such a fragmented soccer community in this country. And again, I'll go back to U.S. soccer shooting themselves in the foot. As the national federation, it is your job to connect entities, macro to macro, micro to micro, and then micro to macro. And so that we have one soccer community where the common goal, the common vision is to develop American soccer players. I've had the wonderful opportunity, and it's part of my own continued professional development. I've got enough licenses to sink a battleship and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I travel to different countries. I like to go to different places and find out, what are you folks doing? How does it work there? I was in Iceland last year for a period of time, and I tell everyone to go there, either as a soccer person or as a tourist. It's just wonderful. And I went to learn what they do in Iceland. And you know, the places that I visited and the research I've done, you find some common themes. A, collaboration. Coaches, entities, clubs, they collaborate because they're on the same page in terms of developing players for their country. You know, this idea of, you know, reflection, you know, individual coaches, clubs, they look back on the things that they have done, they learn from it, and then they move forward to become better soccer coaches, better soccer clubs, better soccer entities. And then they will share that enlightenment, again, I'll go back to collaboration because they can be connected, to other clubs and individuals and coaches. Hey, well, this is what I've learned from my experiences. This is what we have learned from our experiences. Heck, we want to share with you because, again, and it circles back, we're all in the business of developing, I don't know, German players or Belgian players or British players, but in our case, American players. So, you know, in one sense, I agree. We've got so many wonderful entities out there, but if we can't get ourselves on the same page, if we can't get a, we can have a federation that, that can heal wounds and can bring the parties together so that we're on a common vision, common goal, then again, here's the cynic popping his head out there that, you know, are we really going to change? That's my rant, Missy. That's my pontification on what's going on in this country. And I hope it works out. I really do. Here we are in 2020. With the resources that we have, I would like to think that we can be that much better. So, again, that's my rant. So let's shift gears. I really, like I said, I wanted to spend time with you in two areas, that being coaching education and the women's game. So let's start with coaching education. So what drew you to United Soccer Coaches to the point in a very short period of time, you know, we will be calling you president, Missy Price. You'll be taking over from Kevin Sims, who's our current president. What drew you to United Soccer Coaches and to put you in the position where you're at now within our organization?
You know, I think that started from part of my story that I saved till we got to this point is my family values have instilled a strong vein within me about service and how can I give back and what does that look like? You know, whether that's in my local community or where I work or whatever it may be. And so I've always felt strongly about that. And as a kid, I would give back by chaperoning younger teams at events. And, I didn't get paid for any of that stuff. All I got was a dorm room and some food and went with them and made sure they got where they were supposed to be. So I think it was just this sense of soccer and, you know, my life. I talk about this a lot. Coaching is a lifestyle for me and it's part of who I am. I explored, like I said, being a full-time professor and kind of what that would look like for me. And it just didn't feel right. It just didn't fit in the way that coaching college fits for me and doing what I do fits for me. So all of that comes together in the idea of how do I give back? And I heard that message all the time from the people that were mentors for me, whether it was April Heinrichs or, John Daly, who's a former coach at William & Mary, I've seen him and how he has given back to soccer and to the game all through my playing and coaching career, and the connection through different people. There's a lot of people I could mention and rather than try to mention them all and forget some, I'm just going to say that that's been a strong message and it's been something that I've seen in all of my mentors. And it's part of, again, what I feel like I call my obligation. It's part of my calling. It's part of who I am, but it's also part of why I think I was sort of put into the world and why when I was 5 years old or 6 years old, screaming at my mom to be like, Mom, what is that? What is that? I want to play it. It started then and it's continued on throughout my life. So for me, at one point I was a member of the Women's Committee, which is part of United Soccer Coaches. It's now the Women's Coaches Group. So I was a part of that group, just helping to advocate for the women in coaching and the women's game. And through the evolution of my time in that group, I became the chair of that group. And at some point, it became obvious to me that, you know what, I can still do more for this association that I feel like has given so much to me and to other coaches. And I'm going to step up and put myself out there and run for a board position. And the membership built on that and felt that I would do a good job and put me into that position. And for the people out there don't know, you get elected to the board of directors for United Soccer Coaches and you serve in the role of vice president for 4 years, president for 1 year and past president for another year. So it's a 6-year commitment of service to the association. And I have met so many wonderful colleagues. I have feel like we have, you know, worked very hard to continue to move the association forward. I have learned a lot about the association's inner workings, our commitment to education, our commitment to membership, and it's such a rewarding experience, and I'm so incredibly grateful for the opportunity to do it. I don't do it for me. I do it for soccer and for our community. And some people say, like, oh, you know, that sounds like a tagline or something in something you're going to read at the end of the book, like, oh, this was amazing opportunity. But there's value in how you live your life. And I feel like I'm only going to say yes to the things that I'm really passionate about. So rather than do a lot of things, I just do a few things that I truly, truly love. And being on the board of United Soccer Coaches is one of those. And I probably look at it from the standpoint of, if I can make the difference in the lives of coaches in our country, which are also going to make the difference in the lives of all the people they work with, there's no greater gift I could give back to the game because of all the things it's given to me.
So as far as your work on the executive board, you're involved strategic planning and the setting of policies and oversight of business. Without giving away too much, what are some of the things that you do in those areas as a board member with United Soccer Coaches?
So some of the biggest responsibilities are like fiscal responsibility, overseeing the fiscal responsibility of the association and a service to our memberships and the strategic planning, like you mentioned. We also work a lot with advocacy for our coaches, education, obviously huge point that the board focuses on, and the service and how we provide service as an association. So, you know, sometimes those board meetings are, you know, really about the business side of it and hearing from our national staff in the office in Kansas City and our CEO and all the business plans and goals and the work that they're doing, because they're the real core of people on the ground who are doing all the hard work. We're really kind of the oversight and strategic vision of the association, but we're not the only ones, right? The creativity that comes from that group of people as far as marketing, coaching education, and awards and all the other services that we provide is pretty fantastic. So other times we're really, you know, heavily focused on, you know, as of right now, to be honest, the board has been meeting every week via Zoom to make sure that we are servicing our members and supporting them through these challenging times. And also, you know, the financial solvency of the association, like staying really responsible and making sure that we're doing those kinds of things. So we're really on top of things right now and doing everything that we can as a board to support our national office staff and then in turn our members. You know, there's the convention is always a big thing every year, and we spend a lot of time supporting the efforts of our staff doing that. And I think one of the biggest ones is probably the education piece. The coaching education landscape is constantly changing in our country and in the world. And education is one of the most critical services that we provide our members. And I think, you know, more than ever, we have more educational offers than we've ever had as an association. A huge resource library. Right now, there's a 30-day free membership for anyone who isn't a member, and you have access to all of that, the resources that members have. So there's just a lot of opportunity, I think, that we're doing, especially right now, but in general in the education space.
Yeah, as one who's been, you know, a member since 1981, which was just a couple of years ago, and as a national staff coach, national goalkeeper staff coach, blah blah blah. The amount of content, resources, quote unquote stuff that we make available to our soccer community, I think is so very impressive. Talk a little bit about the culture of United Soccer Coaches, then NSCA, but now United Soccer Coaches. What is it about our culture that makes us different, that makes us maybe sets us apart from other entities? And I'll let you fill in the blank what the other entity happens to be.
You know, I think the idea of like congeniality and working together, that collaboration, you know, word that we've tossed around a little bit on this podcast today is United Soccer Coaches really feels like, at least for me, and I hope it does for our members, it feels like a place that coaches can go to for anything they need to support their coaching career. Whether it's you're the parent coach, part-time coach, full-time coach, someone like me who coaches at the collegiate level, and this is like your thing you've been doing, or a club for 20 years, doesn't matter. 5 years, 20 years, 40 years, you know, wherever you are in your coaching career, and whatever your goals are, I'd like to think that our association is a place where coaches can come for all things that they need to be a coach. And that isn't just soccer thrills, right? It's how do you support yourself, you know, from an insurance perspective or a financial perspective? How do you develop all the aspects of the game, the mental side, physiology and fitness, besides the technique and tactics of the game, right? How do you develop things like leadership within your players, and how do you learn more about running your own business, right? Being a coach is so many things to so many different people. And so that's what I'd like to think that we are as an association. Like I said, coaching is my lifestyle, that however it's defined in your life and part of your lifestyle, that we can support you. And I do think we can, and I do think that we do. And we can, I think we're really good at adapting and responding to the changing needs of our coaches. And that comes through being, I think United Soccer Coaches is a place where people feel like they can go to become a better coach and connect with other coaches. And if they don't, then look me up and tell me about it, and we'll make it better for you.
I'm with you. So let's touch the political third rail, shall we?
Okay.
The political third rail relative to coach development, coaching education here in this country, specifically the I guess I can't use the word licensure with United Soccer Coaches, the diploma, the certification, whatever you want to call it, as given through United Soccer Coaches, and the licensure that is you can earn through U.S. Soccer. Now, there was a time when, you know, U.S. Soccer did recognize United Soccer Coaches diploma, and that has just gone by the wayside, when they thought they'd go off on their own and take a different path as to how they would license develop coaches. Is it time to renew the conversation between United Soccer Coaches and U.S. Soccer, so that U.S. Soccer once again, not just formally recognizes, but embraces the United Soccer Coaches entity? It is the world's largest coaching organization. We, and correct me if I'm wrong, Missy, we host the world's largest soccer convention on the planet. But yet we're not formally recognized or embraced. And that's a key word, embraced. They know we're here, but we're not embraced. Is it time to have that renewed conversation with U.S. Soccer so that we are embraced, we are identified, as a viable, important, valuable entity in the soccer coaching education dynamic? I told you that was a third rail.
That is a third rail. You know, of course I'm going to say yes, I do. I think that we have to be willing to, you know, we can use political terms here, you know, cross the party lines and reach across and shake hands and say, let's talk about it. Because, you know, in the end, I think our ultimate goal is the same. I haven't talked to Cindy Parlo Cohn. I haven't had any conversations with U.S. Soccer, but I think in the end, our goal is the same, is that we want to see the growth of soccer in our country. We want to see our national teams, from the youth all the way to the senior teams, be powerhouses in the world, right? We want to see our federation be strong. We want to see our youth development be strong. We want to see soccer as a vehicle for the development of people in the sport, but also we like to win. We want to be a soccer country, right? I think we would all agree with that, but I think the how we want to do that might be different. And that's where I think we need to come together at some point and see if we can be that group that unites the country together in all these other ways that you and I've been talking about. But I don't know. I don't know how we do it. And you're right. There was a time where United Soccer Coaches diplomas, where there's a relationship with U.S. Soccer, where those were seen in a different way, either as to renew, like an A license, for example, or as a certification that would like opt you into like a B license if you hadn't taken your C or something like that, right? There were all these sort of collaborations, and there aren't today. You know, and maybe that's not the answer. It doesn't need to look the same as it did in the past. But can there be more of a connection between what we do and how we do it? There probably can be. And, you know, I do. I think those conversations should and can be had. So hopefully they are had at some point. And, you know, I think we all have things to offer. I know I kind of sound like an over-the-top optimist, but it is. It's my worldview. I think that one of the things I value the most about United Soccer Coaches, especially when I'm at the convention, is all the bright, inspiring coaches that I get to be around, and I don't know thousands of them. But when you listen to their conversations, you meet up with someone you've never met, someone introduces you to someone else, you go to a session, and you're blown away by the information that you're hearing from someone you don't know and have never heard from before. I think that speaks volumes to not just the convention, but to our membership and to the quality of people that are out there in our country that are working in our game. And so I would love to think that it isn't us versus them, whoever the them is, and that we can find a way to be better collaborators. So I'm going to bring that back. But I think we can, Giovanni, and I don't think it'll look the same as it has in the past, but I think there's something that can be there. And if I'm still on the board when it happens, great. If I'm not, I'll still be happy about it.
So as far as the them are concerned, them have a new president, Cindy Parlow Cohn. I don't know if you know her or not. I don't. Full transparency.
I think I played against her.
You did? Did she score against you?
Well, no, I mean, if she did, we were not going to talk about it. I think she might have been at Carolina when I was at Maryland.
There you go. I'm sure you made the save.
But I remember watching her a ton on the national team. I don't know her personally, but I definitely know of her.
Yeah, so where I was going with that question was if, you know, you kind of knew. I'm just curious as to the mindset that she might have relative to this issue, this discussion that we're having, you know, in terms of licensure and formal identification of United Soccer Coaches. You know, I'm hoping that, like you, I'm hoping that phone call, that meeting, that conversation does take place, and she, you know, is open-minded, amenable to revisiting this issue relative to coaching licensure. So, but you're going to be you're going to be president. So I'll be watching, and I'm not too far away now. I'm not too far away. We're close to each other. So I'm going to be checking in on you every once in a while when you're president. So let's shift gears. Again, I wanted to spend some time in coaching education, but I certainly wanted to spend time with discussing your advocacy for women in coaching. What is the landscape like there? Are we making strides? You know, where do we need to go to engage more female coaches? I certainly want to get into the professional game. You know, I my head continues to spin as to why we don't have pro soccer here in the Boston area. I know some of the reasons, you know, I know it, but nonetheless, it still boggles my mind that we don't have a professional soccer team here in the Boston area. But, you know, from the proverbial 50,000 feet looking down on the game for women and for females, where are we at? How are we doing? Yeah, there's a sigh. My goodness, there's a big answer coming.
Yeah, I would like to say that we're doing okay, but I just don't think we are. I don't think that we do enough to develop women into coaching. I don't think there's enough players who finish their playing career and see coaching as a viable profession, either full-time, part-time. Part of that is, you know, the idea that a lot of times if we can see someone doing it, we know that we can do it too, right? And think about the numbers of club players, boys and girls. In general, club players growing up that have a female coach, I've had a female coach. I've had male coaches too. My college coach was female. I also had a male coach in college for a year. My coaches growing up, most of them were female. But I would say like it was at least 50% female, 50% male. What do you think that percentage is today?
You got me. What do we got?
Yeah. I can tell you that of the college players that come to my team, the number that have a female coach, of the 25 players on my team that have had a female coach in their youth career is less than 5.
Oh. And do you have conversations with your players? Because I'm curious, you know, what was that like? I know you maybe have not done like scientific research or a survey, right. But why is the, I guess is the fundamental question, is the case.
You know, I think we see that there's just more men getting jobs than women, and there's all these arguments to that, and you can go down every road, and the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport is huge on women in coaching, not just in soccer, but in all avenues. And there's another association called We Coach, which I'm a member of as well, which is supporting women coaches in all sports at all levels, because there's such a need for it, right? And I think that what you're seeing is more and more women are playing sport in all of our sports, but so few of them are actually going into coaching when it's time for them to be a coach. And a lot of clubs, which I love, is they'll have like their U17s, U18s, maybe be an assistant coach with their U8 team, you know, right? And the girls and even the boys are being exposed to coaching. Even having more women coaching boys, because then you're getting the idea that half our population is also learning that women can coach, right? Because they, most of them, almost 100%, not all, but almost 100% grow up with a same gendered coach, right? Whereas on the female side, most of the girls, especially in soccer, but in a lot of sports across our country, are growing up with men as their coaches. And guys aren't a bad thing, right? This is not a bash on the guys out there. But if we want to have more women in coaching, we need more women in coaching at our youngest level, so kids can grow up seeing that this is something that women do. And I think that that is what's important. And for some of that is the support of women coaches. There are some sort of gender stereotypes at play here, like coaching takes you, you know, if you just take youth soccer, for example, if you're a club coach, right, you might be sort of staying at home all day, or you might have let's say you're a full-time club coach, you're at home during the day, planning your trainings, doing other things that your responsibilities you might have in your club, and then all night long you're coaching your players, and you're gone on the weekends coaching your team. And if you have children who especially, you know, are sort of at-home age children, not in school yet, there's sometimes this obligation of still culturally, the woman stays home. This is not the case everywhere, but the woman stays home with the kids. The guy goes to work. So some of that's at play in coaching. Women may not feel like it's okay for them to take on a coaching role where they're not at home when their kids get home from school to make dinner. They're not at home with them on the weekends. So they're navigating those challenges, and they're not supported the same way just from a societal standpoint, where there's gender stereotypes at play there. The other idea is the hiring bias. People tend to hire people who are like them. So just case in point, Giovanni, the feminist on the call, you know, you're a male and in your club, you might have a tendency, not saying you do, but if we're talking about the bias, is to hire men or people who are more like you, even in your style and other things, and women might not fit that. And so there's an issue with dealing with hiring bias. And since most DOCs, the majority of our DOCs in our country are male, that's a factor at play when you're talking about, especially our club soccer and at the collegiate level. There's more male ADs than there are female, right? And so there's a number of different things that I think come into play here, and I only touched on a couple. But my biggest one that I try to sort of advocate for and feel like where I can make the most change is the idea is if you can see her, you can be her. And so I had a player graduate a couple of years ago who I thought she has a love for the game. She sees the game really well. She's got a great demeanor. And I just flat out said, I know you want to be a doctor, but you'd also make a great coach. So when you get done med school or on the side to keep you in the game, however you do it, find a way to be a coach. And she was like, I would love to be a coach. And I think sometimes it takes that. It takes people like me, a woman in coaching. So to all the female coaches out there, find someone, find a player that you work with and encourage them to be a coach. Male coaches, same thing, encourage a female to be a coach. But I think it's even more important when you're someone who's a female mentor for them, encourages them to go out and do something they see their mentor doing. But I think male coaches can have the same thing, and you can be a strong mentor for a female coach. You just need to know how to support them, and it may not be the same way you were supported. And it may not be the same way that you found success in your career. So someone like you, someone like any male coach out there, male coaches who are head coaches at the college level and have female assistants working under them, be an active and responsible mentor and find out how to mentor them. And if you don't know, go to the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport and learn, because there's tons of resources up there. Reach out to different coaches organizations if you're part of United Soccer Coaches. Get involved with the Women's Coaches Advocacy Group. You don't have to be a woman to be involved. If you want to advocate for women in the women's game, get involved, because that's a way to also learn about how to support women coaches and grow coaching for women in our sport. So those would be some of my ways that I would encourage our coaches in soccer to get out there and help make a difference so that we can have more women in the game.
You know, one of the things I've advocated as a coach educator was to offer coaching education courses to girls high school teams and women's college programs, where you go in and you teach a coaching education course. And when I was a head coach in college, I did it every year I coached men's. I did a coaching education course. It was usually, you know, going back again, I'll show you how old I am, going back to the state course we used to run 1,000 years ago. And, you know, now it's the 4-versus-4 grassroots. And that was it's a quick, easy, 3-hour, 4-hour commitment to the players. But for me, it was an opportunity to plant the seeds of maybe a potential coach going forward. I'm a firm believer that you can build the next generation of coaches, male and female, by getting them early, whether you do a simple coaching education course at the high school level or at the college level, and you plant a seed. And then there is that young lady or young ladies who are like, well, this is cool. This is great. I didn't know about coaching. And maybe that seed, when nurtured, she grows literally to becoming a soccer coach. That's one of the things I've advocated, you know, kind of getting them early. My politics lean very heavily progressive. I'd like to see our coaching community be reflective of our society. And that means, you know, it runs the gamut, whether you're male, female, black, white, and everything else in between that's out there. I'd like to see our coaching community be representative of the demographics of our country. So, geez, Missy, we covered it all. We even touched that third rail, which we did well. We didn't get burned. We're okay. Well, we don't know if we've gotten burned, but I think we're okay. If someone wanted to get a hold of you, contact you, they want to learn more about Wellesley College, your work as a coach educator, United Soccer Coaches, what's the best way to get a hold of Dr. Missy Price?
Well, I'd like to think that if you just Googled me, nothing bad will come up. So if you Google Missy Price and Wellesley College, you'll find me. I am happy to share my contact information, like my email address and things like that, with everyone. It's kind of complicated in a way to talk about on a podcast, but it's M Price. So my Missy Price. So M Price, the number 5@wellesley.edu. So I'll throw that out there to the world, because you can easily find it online as well at the Wellesley Athletics website, as well as my phone number for my office there too. I'm happy to support all of our coaches out there. I can field a number of different questions from coaches, parents, you know, where, whatever you need. I feel like I said at the beginning, like, this is a passion. This is an obligation. It's my life's work. It's what I love doing. And any way I can get back to the game, I will do it. So if anybody has any questions, ways they think I can help, please reach out.
That's great. And I do hope that, you know, when you become president of United Soccer Coach, you'll be a returning guest on the GP Soccer podcast. It's not often you get the president of an organization right there on your show. So I'm hoping that I didn't scare you today, that indeed you'll be a returning guest, because I, as you very well know, I'm very dedicated to the organization, and would like to hear what's going on in the future. And certainly in your role as president, you could offer some valuable insight and information going forward. So our guest today was Missy Price, women's soccer coach over at Wellesley College in Wellesley, Massachusetts. God willing, we'll be playing soccer in the fall. And if you are in the Boston area, please take the time to head over to Wellesley College, again in Wellesley, Massachusetts, to check out our teams, watch them play, and support the women's game at every level, but in this case, at the college level. So I'm Giovanni Bicini, host of the GP Soccer Podcast. We're going to take a real short commercial break. And on the other side, we're going to come back with the yellow card, I've got a yellow card to dole out today. So again, GP Soccer Podcast, please don't you go anywhere. Hey, Giovanni Pacini here, host of the GP Soccer Podcast. As you all know, the main theme of the show revolves around player and coach development, both really important issues here in the United States. It's my hope that when you listen to the show, in essence, it becomes a mini coaching education course of sorts. And when you finish listening, you're that much more enlightened about the things that we as soccer coaches need to implement into our regular soccer routines and practices. If you like what you've heard, and I certainly hope that you do, well, share it. Share it with those within your own soccer network. It might be amongst those within your youth soccer or club organizations, or your soccer friends and colleagues in general. I'm hoping that this becomes coaches helping coaches. That's what I'm trying to do with the show. So, if you like what you hear, tell everyone.
This is Brad Feldman, voice of the New England Revolution. You're listening to the GP Soccer Podcast with your host, Giovanni Pacini.
Welcome back to the GP Soccer Podcast. I am your host, you know who I am, Giovanni Pacini. I want to thank once again Dr. Missy Price for being a guest on the GP Soccer Podcast. A lot of fun chatting with her. As you now know, having listened to the interview, she and I are very much involved with United Soccer Coaches. She more on kind of an administrative side, I guess I'll call it, you know, serving as a secretary and vice president, and all the way up to now her soon to becoming president, and in my role as the coach educator. So it was great talking with her, and I look forward to our actually meeting face to face. You know, this coronavirus thing is preventing a lot of people from getting together with you. You know, you know them or not. So we haven't yet to meet, she and I, face to face, but I look forward to that day and carrying on our conversation. And again, many thanks to her. We covered a lot of great areas in the game, in all aspects of soccer in the United States. So anyways, moving forward, yellow card. Yep, here's a yellow card. And if you listen to the interview, you could probably guess, you know, where I'm going to issue the yellow card, but let's kind of put the yellow card in context here, you know, before I actually flash the yellow card to this entity. So, you know, if you're a soccer player and you're out there in the field and, you know, you do something and the referee blows the whistle and calls you over in that, you know, demanding fashion with that wave of the hand, and then they throw the yellow card up, you know, it's called a warning. It's a yellow card warning. And essentially it means, hey, don't do that again. Don't do that again. And you try not to, because as we all know, the second yellow is a red and it's adios, you're out of the game. So this is a yellow card warning, and we want to make sure that this entity doesn't make the same mistake that the player hopes that they don't make on the soccer field. And that's U.S. soccer. That's U.S. soccer. So I'm going to give you a yellow card warning here, U.S. soccer, specifically in the area of coaching licensure, coaching education. And it is my hope that with some new leadership over at U.S. Soccer and new presidential leadership at United Soccer Coaches, that maybe for the first time in a long time, that there can be a respective meeting of the minds so that U.S. soccer formally, and the key word there is formally, embraces and acknowledges United Soccer Coaches as an important, viable, and strong entity in terms of coaching education. As I noted with Missy in the interview, you know, it's the largest coaching organization, on the planet. And if you've attended the convention, you know it is arguably one of the largest, if not the largest, collection of soccer coaches anywhere to be found in the world. It's a dynamic, wonderful, wonderful thing to be a part of. So when you have an entity, an organization, that being United Soccer Coaches, of that level, of that magnitude, with that type of long history, we've been around since 1941, it's time to think differently. It's time to think differently. We are the United States of America. We're not Brazil. We're not Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, England. You've heard me say it before. We are the United States of America. We're a different soccer beast, and we must function accordingly. Function accordingly. And that also means, getting a formal connection with college soccer, high school soccer, but that's a conversation for me for another day. I want to focus in on the licensure certification process that is so vital to ensuring that we develop some of the best coaches, not just in this country, but in the world. So my yellow card warning goes to U.S. soccer. Please don't make the same mistake again as players are trying to avoid when they get on the field. Try not to do that again, and have a meeting of the minds between these two organizations so that we can combine and even do a better job serving our soccer constituents across this wonderful country of ours. So that's our yellow card warning. That's our yellow card warning for today. Listen, okay, you know what's coming next. Say it with me. If you like what you heard today, tell everyone. If you didn't, tell everyone anyway. If you'd like to advertise on the GP Soccer Podcast, you can contact me, Giovanni Pacini, at GP4Soccer, and that's the number 4, at yahoo.com, or at 617-968-1800. This is Giovanni Pacini of the GP Soccer Podcast, and yes, indeed, I'll catch you later.